Council, welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. As you have gleaned from your information sheet, we have read the record and the briefs in this case, and we're familiar with the facts. So if it helps you streamline your presentation, so be it. Even though there are two cases, they essentially are the same matter, so I'm assuming that 15 minutes aside is acceptable to you. There'll be 5 minutes rebuttal for the appellant, indicated by the yellow light. I'd ask that you turn off pagers and cellular telephones so that we're not bothered. And with that request, counsel, you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jay Reinen, and I represent the appellants Bonnie and Jacqueline Sawyer in this matter. This is, an interesting procedural matter of a fairly, I believe, arcane rule about which not much has been written. Rule 25 is the rule that allows for substitution of parties when a person who is involved in litigation dies during the course of litigation. That's what happened here. I was representing Hollis Sawyer, who was a woman who lived in a nursing home owned by the Kindred defendants. After she filed her lawsuit, she unfortunately passed away, and I notified the court through
Mr. Ryan, if I can ask you to stay by the podium because this is being recorded.
Absolutely. Sorry, I have a pacing problem. She was, I notified the court through what I titled as a suggestion of death, which is, I guess, sort of a misnomer in this case, but a suggestion of death that Mrs. Sawyer had passed away, and whatever proceedings would be halted. The problem that arose in this case is that defendants later, after the daughters decided to file their own wrongful death suit and CCPA suit, looked upon the first court's dismissal of Mrs. Sawyer's claims as being res judicata as to the daughter's claims. They filed a motion for dismissal in Division 3, where the case was subsequently filed, and the court in Division 3 dismissed the case, finding that the four elements of res judicata had been met. The problem with the ruling is manifest. There are several issues that the trial court in Division 3 abused its discretion on. First is Rule 25 itself. If you look at the black letter text of Rule 25, it has a certain number of prerequisites that need to be met in order for a court to dismiss under this rule. It says, if a party dies and the claim is not thereby extinguished, the court may order substitution of the proper parties. Well, when Mrs. Sawyer died, her claims for negligence were extinguished. She had a negligence claim against the facility, saying that you had given me the wrong medications in the wrong dose and had allowed me to fall a number of times, and that injured me. At the time Mrs. Sawyer had died, obviously she had not filed a wrongful death claim because, A, she wasn't able to file a wrongful death claim, and B, because a wrongful death claim can only be brought by the heirs after someone passes away. So under the Colorado Survival Statute, Mrs. Sawyer's claims for her personal negligence injuries of non-economic loss were extinguished. And so this rule, by the very first line, does not apply.
Well, Mr. Ryan, Section 1320.101 says, all causes of action except actions for slander or libel shall survive and may be brought notwithstanding the death of the person in favor of or against whom such action has accrued. You're the person who filed the suggestion of death, rather unusual term in the art of the law, and you used that term to describe the pleading that you filed under Rule 11. So I'm assuming that that suggestion of death, read together with 1320.101.1, says that that negligence claim survives.
Well, Your Honor, I believe if you read on that statute that you're referring to, the survival statute, it specifically states that claims for non-economic loss in tort do not survive, and that's what the sole claims by Mrs. Sawyer were in the first case. She was not making claims for lost wages, for example. She wasn't making claims of an economic nature. And she was making claims for pain and suffering and non-economic loss associated with the injuries that she sustained at the facility. So when she died, those claims by statute were extinguished.
I'm going from memory, Mr. Reinen, but I thought I had seen that she, and I recognize it may have been boilerplate in the complaint, but sought economic and non-economic damages. Am I wrong about that?
Well, the economic portion of the damages would have been for any increased medical care, which to that point in time had not been determined by the time that she died.
Sure, but there was a claim for it.
There was technically a claim for it, but that was extinguished by her death. The non-economic loss portion is really what we're talking about. The wrongful death.
So I think you may have just misspoken.
Sure.
I think the economic portion was not
right.
Okay.
Right. But it was. The economic portion could not be brought by her daughters. In other words, her daughters could not bring in their wrongful death claim a claim for their mother's medical bills, etc.
But her estate could.
Her estate could.
That's the point of the statute. It says you can substitute. I mean, I think normally that what would happen is the estate would substitute and bring the negligence claim. And as I read the survival statute, and correct me if I'm reading it wrong, all it says is in a negligence case like this is you can't bring for the non-economic damages anymore.
That's correct, but that's the minor portion of the overall claim. In these types of claims, in nursing home claims, primarily you're dealing with elderly people who are not working, who are retired, who have very little in the way of economic loss. The daughter's claims were separate and apart from that. The daughter's claims for wrongful death. Wrongful death is the recognition, statutory recognition by the General Assembly, that when someone dies as a result of another person's negligence, you can make claims for the surviving heirs' pain and suffering from the loss of their mother, father, or their loved one that has passed away. Those are different than the claims brought by Mrs. Hollis Sawyer against the facility.
Aren't they derivative of the negligence claim? And isn't there a myriad of case law stating the same?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I point you to the Fish v. Lilly case. Says the cause of action created by the wrongful death statute is separate and distinct from the action which the deceased would have for personal injuries had he survived. The wife's action is rooted in the statute itself, and the elements of her damage are essentially different from those proper for consideration of personal injury action to which her injured husband would have been entitled if death had not ensued. That's the real problem with this case, I think, first and foremost, is that the children's wrongful death case is not wholly derivative of the mother's negligence case, because they're talking about two different types of injuries. If you read it the way that the defendants would have you read it, then the daughters would be entitled to make some sort of a death claim for their mother's pain and suffering, which is clearly disallowed. When someone dies, the heirs have the right to make a separate claim for their own pain and suffering associated with the death of their loved one. That is different than Mrs. Sawyer's claim that she had been injured by the facility, and that's what the Fish v. Lilly case and also the Daggles case from 1981 recognize. And I guess that's where the confusion, I get this a lot in the line of work that I'm in, is sort of we talk about when someone dies, the family, the heirs at law, cannot bring a claim for the pain and suffering associated with the decedent. The decedent's pain and suffering dies with them. And so here, the children's claim did not even arise and was not created until their mother had died.
Of course, the derivative nature of the claims here, the claim that you're seeking to advance is the Colorado Consumer Protection Act claim. And that's the kind of claim that seeks both economic damages, non-economic damages, and is directly related to the negligence claim in every respect.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. The CCPA is a claim that the daughters brought by saying, you buffaloed me into placing our mother at this facility by lying about the nature and extent of the services that you could provide. And that's different than the mother saying, you didn't give me the right pills, you gave me the wrong dosage, and you let me fall a bunch of times, and I got hurt.
Doesn't it also allege that the services rendered did not comport with certain standards?
Well, that's not really the CCPA claim goes to the knowingly false promises about the nature and extent of the services, as well as the failure to tell people about what services were and were not provided. CRS section 6-1-105 sub 1 U claim for a failure to provide material non-disclosures is what that subsection is about. I see
Ron,
that.
I know you want to reserve time. I'll make it quick.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I understand. Mom here brought just a negligence claim.
Right.
Daughters then brought wrongful death and CCPA.
Correct.
Your position is wrongful death is different than negligence. I understand your position. Res judicata requires us to look at claims that could have been brought. Could not the mother have brought a CCPA claim here?
I suppose one could argue that she did. The reason that she didn't was because she didn't make the placement decision. She was incompetent. And the advertising is all targeted to the family members and the daughters anyway, because normally nursing home placement is made by family members. The decision is made by family members because often the nursing home resident doesn't have the cognitive abilities to make that decision. So these advertisements are targeted to the family. The tours are targeted to the family. The family didn't want to participate in this lawsuit, and they stayed out of it until after their mom had died. And so the concern that I have is not only shrinking the statute of limitations from 3 years and 2 years respectively down to 90 days, that they'd have to decide to bring a wrongful death and CCPA action after their mom died, but also in saying that the mom's negligence claim is the same as the wrongful death claim, which the Fish v. Lilly Daigle's estate all say is a creature of statute that measures two different types of non-economic loss. With that, I'll reserve my time if I could. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Quinn. I represent the Kindred defendants. When I was preparing for this, I was struck again with the myriad, I think, as Mr. Reinert, of legal issues that were raised in the appellate briefs. As I tried to sort them out and put them together, what came to me was the simplicity and accuracy of Judge Hoffman's order of dismissal, and how two other Denver District Courts reached essentially the same conclusion on the issues. So I think Judge Hoffman's order of dismissal is a good place to start and use as a framework for the analysis of this argument today. Rule 25 talks about claims not extinguished surviving. Claims not extinguished. And in this case, the court has already touched on the claims that weren't extinguished, but let me quickly review them. You are correct that Mrs. Hollis's economic claims were not distinguished, and in fact, they weren't quite as simple as Mr. Reinan laid them out to be a moment ago. I have a copy of the original complaint, and in that, not necessarily boilerplate, but to quote, which is part of the record, plaintiff's injuries include economic and non-economic loss in addition to permanent impairment. Plaintiff's economic loss includes increased doctor and hospital bills, and then, of course, as he just mentioned, as well as the need for permanent skilled nursing placement. Of course, the original claim contained a claim for damages for the harm that was caused by the alleged negligence while Ms. Sawyer was still alive. So you're right. So there's one part of the claim that was not extinguished as addressed in Rule 25. There were two other parts of the claim that were not extinguished. There was the wrongful death, and there was the CCPA. We have already discussed, indeed, or the court has discussed and identified that the wrongful death claim is derivative of Mrs. Sawyer's negligence claim.
Well, Mr. Crane, could you address the, you rely on the Steedle case for that, or one as one of the cases. I guess I see that as distinct. I mean, Steedle, as I read it, the court was distinguishing between loss of consortium claims, which belong to each individual person, and a wrongful death claim. And here I can understand the position why the estate maybe is out of luck, assuming service was proper, which is a different issue, you know, that they got the right notice under Rule 25. But it seems to me, and I'd like you to respond to this, why is the estate's claim the same as the daughter's individual wrongful death claim? The estate would take over the negligence claim, the economic portion of it, under the survival statute.
Yes.
I understand. Why, your position has to be, I guess, that is necessarily the same claim as the daughter's wrongful death claim, or at least the daughter somehow are in privity with the estate.
Sure.
And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that presumption, but I'd like you to address that.
Sure.
Well, I think it's going to encompass it, perhaps a little bit, several issues, and I'll try and wrap them all up into one. First of all, I do rely on the Steedle and the Pizza Hut of America versus O'Keefe case and the Crownover case versus Gleichman. So there's a number of cases that have reached the cause of action created by the Wrongful Death Statute Act, arises out of tortious acts which injured the decedent and resulted in the decedent's death. The survivor's right of action is derivative of and dependent upon the right of action which the decedent would have had she survived the injuries. So you had the original injury, which is part of what Judge Hoffman noticed when he said, look, you have to differentiate between issues and causes of action. And a cause of action is when you have, when your claim focuses on an injury. And the injury in this case was the injury to the alleged injuries to Mrs. Sawyer. So I guess I'm trying to work my way towards your answer. So you have the injury, you have the wrongful death claim that is, you have the tort claim that is filed, and then you have the death. And so what you end up really with is, is somewhat of an election of remedies at this point, because the plaintiffs chose to pursue, as Judge Hoffman identified in his order, a suggestion of death under Rule 25. So as the plaintiffs pursued, and I know it's a long way from your derivative question, but what happened is they had a claim, and they had these derivative claims that were related to the actual injury. And so once they filed the suggestion of death under Rule 25, that triggered a substitution of parties if they wished to go forward on the claims that were either survived or derivative of the original cause of action.
Mr. Quinn, you could have filed a motion for substitution of parties yourself.
I could have. I agree. But I didn't have to. The plaintiffs were the ones who filed the suggestion of death.
Well, the reason I asked the question is because I'm simply not able to find any cases that cite the Stoddard case out of Utah, but I find a host of federal cases that say that you have to personally serve non-parties. And in light of that, I suppose you could have filed a motion to substitute parties and triggered that problem.
In the court, and so let me see if I can continue on to make sure we're on the same page. So what you're saying is that the suggestion of death was filed, but notice of that suggestion of death was not given to the daughters.
Wasn't personally served. There's nothing in the record to indicate that it was personally served.
Under Rule 4.
Okay, and I'm not sure that we read, is it your position? I guess I want to ask, make sure.
Well,
that Rule 20. Okay, I'm sorry. I want to make sure I answer the question.
I'm desperately trying to figure this out.
I want to make sure we're on the same page. Is it the court asking me, does Rule 25A1 require that the suggestion of death be served upon the daughters?
You said it more brilliantly and artfully than I.
I would say no.
That's exactly. And in support of that position, I see you cite the Stoddard case.
Yes.
Out of Utah.
I also looked at Rule 25A1. It says the suggestion of death upon the record is made by service of a statement of the fact of death as provided herein on the service of the motion and the filing of the proof thereof. But it doesn't say on who, the non-parties. We certainly received it. It was served in our case, and we are the party that have to continue to defend the claim if the substituted parties entered.
Well, it does say Mr. Quinn shall be served on the parties as provided in Rule 5 and upon persons not parties in the manner provided in Rule 4. That has to mean something.
But
the federal cases say that means successors in interest and the PR.
Okay, but that would be the motion for substitution of parties. The motion for substitution may be made by any party. This is what I read this is the suggestion of death was made pursuant to the statute by the plaintiffs. Once that happened, the next thing happened, and that is the plaintiffs had to substitute within 90 days.
But it does say the next sentence, which you're relying on, I see your point. The sentence I read is followed by a sentence that says suggestion of death is made by service of a statement of the fact of death as provided herein for service of the motion. So it seems to me that service of this statement of death has to be served the same way. Rule 5 on parties, Rule 4 on non-parties. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Say, boy, I don't see it that way. I see it two different issues. I see one as a pleading called a substitution of parties. I see another pleading called a suggestion of death. The substitution of parties doesn't trigger anything. It just is the substitution of parties. The suggestion of death does trigger something to happen, and that is the substitution of parties. Maybe it's a poorly constructed statute, but nonetheless, it says what it says.
But doesn't it say it has to be served the same way you would file the motion, which would suggest service on non-parties under Rule 4?
I guess, Your Honor, we disagree. I mean, I understand. I think
we
disagree with the interpretation of 25A1.
Okay.
Okay.
If I can ask you something in terms of your derivative argument, Mr. Quinn, on the survival statute, it seems to me your argument would make the last sentence of Section 1320.101.1 superfluous. It talks about survival of a negligence claim. Then the last sentence is, an action under this section shall not preclude an action for wrongful death under Part 2. If they're derivative, why do you need that sentence in the statute? It doesn't become superfluous?
It shall not preclude.
Because you can bring a wrongful death claim, or somebody can bring a wrongful death claim,
yeah,
notwithstanding the rest of the statute.
I don't disagree with that at all. But what happened here is that the plaintiffs filed a suggestion of death. When they filed the suggestion of death, they had 90 days to substitute in the parties and state the cause of actions for which they were pursuing. They didn't do that. Judge Manzanares dismissed. They tried to refile. Judge Hoffman said that's not going to happen either. And that's what happened. Now, if the plaintiffs could have gone a different direction, they could have dismissed without prejudice under Rule 41. And I believe what you then have is an opportunity to file the wrongful death action and a CCPA action. You know, we could fight over the CCPA action. I understand that. I get that. You know, and I think we come out on top. To be honest with you on that, but that's a different point. But the fact is that they are the ones who triggered the activity under 25A1, not the defendants. And once that happened, this is the consequence of filing the suggestion of death. And let me go back, and I had it just about the notice. I mean, I think it is at some point disingenuous for the plaintiffs, appellants, to argue, but no notice. The defendants could have done it, the court could have done it, but we didn't have to do it. Clearly, the suggestion of death said it says right in there, I'm sorry, I've already made a mess here, we are discussing this, the children of the decedent are discussing this together at this time. To say that they didn't get notice of it it indicates that the discussions have already started and that the children of the decedent are involved in the discussions of their legal remedies.
Mr. Quinn, I think you're you're correctly reciting what that suggestion of death says. The difficulty is that on the strength of this record, there doesn't appear to be a proof of service process.
And if that's true, doesn't that create a jurisdictional issue?
Well, I go back to my earlier argument. I'm not going to be, you know, I read the statute differently. I think to say it's a jurisdictional issue is to, well, let me put it this way. I do think that even if the suggestion of death wasn't, if the argument stands that the suggestion of death wasn't properly served, albeit they had notice because they claimed they discussed it, there was subsequently a motion to dismiss that was filed that was properly served upon the plaintiffs that indicated that a suggestion of death had been filed and that the time for the suggestion of death under the statute had expired and there had been no response. The plaintiffs again ignored their responsibility. If they elected to, if they wanted to, they didn't. I don't say ignore because it is some sort of pejorative term. They read it, they understood it, it was properly served, it was given to their lawyer, it was served upon them. And they had an understanding that the suggestion that this previous issue had been raised. So I don't think that you could, at this stage of the lawsuit, they can say they didn't have notice. At this point, what I'd like to do is to talk about the shrinking statute to 90 days. You know, just real briefly, I don't believe the statute is shrunk under 90 days. Once again, it is the plaintiff's obligation. Once they file that suggestion of death, then they have to get in and substitute themselves as parties. You know, this happens all the time. If you file a lawsuit, and let's just call it a wrongful death claim, and you file it 5 months in after the event, at some point under Rule 16, the trial court will issue a deadline in which you have to amend parties or amend claims.
But
and after that,
it would be the wrong party, wouldn't it? I mean, the substitution here would be by the estate or the PR, so
okay.
You know, technically, and their claim would be the surviving piece of the negligence. Aren't we talking about, and I recognize it's somewhat of a fiction because there's
sure.
People wearing different hats.
Sure.
But you're suggesting, I understand the position, assuming we have there's no jurisdiction problem, the estate is out of luck. The estate
right.
Didn't substitute. But why does that bar the daughters from bringing individual claims? On your theory, what needed to happen was the estate needed to substitute, then the daughters needed to move to intervene to bring personal wrongful death claims. And I'm not sure what the authority for that is. That would be on your theory, as I understand it, that would be the only way to preserve their claims without bringing a separate lawsuit. It's not an amendment issue, I guess is what I'm saying. The estate can't amend to bring the wrongful death claims. It has to be an intervention by the daughters. I know your time's up, but I'd appreciate an answer to my question.
Okay. The estate can intervene to bring whatever's left of the original action. The daughters can intervene. The daughters are already in, if I'm, you know, I'm going to confess right now, I'd like to, taking this cold, but the daughters would already be in as heirs of the estate. And the state can ask for an extension of time in which for the individual members of the estate to review the nature of the claims that they might have. And that does happen with a routine basis. And that's how claims are preserved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clinton. Mr. Ryden, you have 3 minutes and 5 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The service issue is an important issue. As Judge Graham pointed out, the Stoddard case kind of sits alone in the world as far as not requiring service. The Grand Boucher case, which I think is an excellent Tenth Circuit case that recites what the federal law is, says the running of the 90-day limitations period under Rule 25A1 is not triggered unless a formal suggestion of death is made on the record, regardless of whether the parties have knowledge of a party's death. And it goes on later, says, further, suggestion of death must be served in accordance with Rule 25A1. Defendants argue that the requirement of service was satisfied in the instant case during the initial appellate proceedings because supplemental briefs in this court's order were served on the attorneys for the parties, including decedent's attorney, who was also the attorney for the decedent's estate. While services of suggestion of death on counsel will satisfy the rule requirement of Rule 25-1 for service of parties to litigation, the service required by Rule 25-A1 on non-parties, specifically the successors or representatives of the deceased party's estate, must be served pursuant to Rule 4. And that's the problem here, is in going back to what happened, Mrs. Sawyer died. The family wasn't sure whether they were going to bring a wrongful death claim or any other claims, but they had 2 years to decide because their claims did not accrue until Mrs. Sawyer died. They weren't standing in the shoes as personal wrongful death plaintiffs, not standing in the shoes of Mrs. Sawyer to bring claims for the suffering and grief of their mother's death, but rather had enjoyed new claims with a new statute of limitations, and that's why they could and did wait. There is no requirement for them to join their mother's claim within 90 days and then ask the court to amend and to intervene, which is what they would have had to do, and Judge Gabriel brought that up. If on day 60, the daughters had joined or moved to substitute in, what claim would they have? They would have their mother's negligence claim. They would not have their own wrongful death claim. So what they would have to do is move to intervene, and then they would have to move to amend the complaint to include their new claims, and the court could turn them down. That's why Rule 25 doesn't require what the defendants say that it does. These are new claims. They may be somewhat derivative in nature, but they are new claims for relief which were not part of their mother's death and not extinguished by her death. I do agree with the court, after listening to arguments, I do agree that the estate would have had to substitute in with 90 days. I think that's fairly clear that the estate would. So I think the estate claims probably go away. But the daughter's new claims for wrongful death and under the CCPA, which they could not have brought and need not have brought in their mother's claim, cannot be dismissed under Rule 25. And that's the relief that I'd ask for from this court.
Thank you, Mr. Reinen. Thank you again, Mr. Quinn, for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket of oral arguments for today, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
All rise. The court will be in recess, subject to call.